I could not understand myself without her as the tether. She felt like a stake in the ground that I was rooted to. And some of that honestly is religion, because she was so faithful and she had an organizing structure that when I felt out of control, I would call her and say, can you call up your little old ladies and pray about this, even though I don't really believe in that? And so it was that way of like, she would provide me a safe way of love and care that without her, I felt very just unlike myself. Unlike myself in my own body, unlike myself in the world.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift.
Welcome to Shapes of Grief. I'm delighted today to be joined by Megan Reardon Jarvis in Washington, D.C. Megan, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me, Liz. I'm delighted to be here. I'm a big fan of your show.
So one of the lovely things about doing the Shapes of Grief podcast is I have all these new internet friends, and you're somebody I met on Instagram.
Yes, we have a little mutual love affair on Instagram. Thank you so much.
And your blog is called Grief is My Side Hustle. Megan, yes. When did you start doing this blog?
So I lost my dad to cancer in 2017, and that small cell cancer took him about a year to die. And I used all my normal routes going to therapy, and they were successful. I got supported. I felt good. In 2019, when I was on vacation with my mom at her house, I had my kids, my dog, and my husband there. She died suddenly in her sleep. And that was just a completely different experience. And my process for that, even though I am a trauma therapist, I've been in the world of therapy for over 20 years. I was really scrambling to get like a handhold to feel steady. And I had had some inpatient acute trauma treatment, which was really helpful. And then in 6 months after her death at Christmas, I came over to the UK because my husband is English and we were spending Christmas with his family. And it was this really jarring experience of having seen people I hadn't seen since my mom had died. People who were very generous, sent flowers. But it was the first time I had physically seen them. And there was very little conversation. Inquiry, and it was a holiday, my first real significant holiday without her. And it wasn't that term of gaslighting, but I felt super crazy. And I did something I had never done before. I mean, I'm building a webpage. I had no internet presence of any kind. I had like 9 friends on Facebook, and most of them were my 5 siblings. And so I just wrote a little story, which was when my mom, she had a short illness when she had been sick, I begged her to let me take her to the emergency room. And my mom was a tiny woman. So I knew from the experience of being in the hospital with my dad and being a hospital social worker that I need to bring some socks and a sweater. And when we got to the hospital, I asked her if she wanted the sweater and socks. And she said no, because she was not feeling well and irritable. And as they gave her fluids and she started to get better, I could see she was freezing. So she said, okay, give me the socks and the sweater. And so I gave them to her. Well, I gave her the sweater and I realized I didn't have the socks, but I had already offered her the socks. So I very surreptitiously took the socks off my feet and put them on her feet. And my mom was so many things, but she had an amazing, just caustic sense of humor. So she's sitting there with this IV in and she's, you know, bundled up and she's a little bit scared. And she says to me, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Did you take these socks off your feet?" And I was like, "Yes, you needed socks." And she looked down at them and they were like athletic socks that have symbols on them. And one symbol was like in pink and one was in purple. She's like, "Can I ask you another question?" And I was like, "Okay." And she was like, "Why don't young people care if their socks match anymore?" And it was just this really funny moment. And I was like, "Woman, just shut up and say thank you for the socks." You know, and then 6 days later, she died. And so it's a story
that better. You went on holidays and then she died suddenly.
Yeah. So that was part of the holidays. I was staying with her and she was sick. She got sick. We had had a trip together in Maine and then I came and stayed at her house and she got sick. And so I was remembering this story standing in a bathroom in my in-law's house, looking down at my socks because they were two different color athletic socks. And so I had that, you know, that wild experience that we have of just being crippled by grief and just no outlet. I mean, it would have been very odd for me to go downstairs and in tears because that wasn't how I was presenting. So I just started writing on the internet. And like anything else, when you put real feelings out there, I had a lot of people respond, people I didn't know necessarily, because I made it public. I made it public by mistake, by the way. I'm just like not that internet savvy.
But what really hits me in what you're sharing here, Megan, is just this sense of this nervous system that's so awake and activated in pain.
Yeah.
And everybody else just getting on with their holiday and
yeah.
And it's invisible. And it's almost like your nervous system is screaming, "See me. I'm really suffering here. Acknowledge this." And everyone is like, "Do you want coffee? Shall we go for a walk?" And this is why we really desperately need grief education, because until somebody has been in that space, I say to my clients sometimes when they're describing this disparity between how they're feeling and how their friends or family are behaving, I say it's like you're on Lyric FM and they're on Today FM. You're on completely different frequencies and they have no idea what's going on at your frequency.
What it reminded me of, and it continues to remind me of sometimes, you know, I'm 47 now. I, you know, have done the hard scramble of life of being a woman where, you know, I wear the clothes that I want. I say what I want. I read what I want. I eat what I want. But I have really good memories, acute memories of being a very self-conscious teenager, you know, putting on a denim jacket, not sure if it looks good, wondering if people are looking at me, wondering. There's a self-consciousness in that turning inward that happens in grief. Because the thing that I say, and I say to my clients all the time, is that, you know, while you are not alone, because everyone grieves at some point in their life. It just depends on what timeline you're on. I'm in grief now, you're not. It is an alone experience. Everyone grieves their person all by themselves. So you know, when people say you're not alone, you are alone. The relationship that I lost with my mom is different than what my sister lost. And even though we can have a conversation of connection, that, you know, on Christmas morning, she's in a good mood, I'm devastated, you know, I just am alone in that moment. And it reminds me of being a really self-conscious teenager, of trying to figure out who I am in this moment, not just how I feel, but who I am. And that was the phrase I said to my husband a lot after my mom died, which was, "I don't know who to be."
Yeah.
Because the tethering of a really core person anchors you in your understanding of yourself. And so it's, you know, we have all these words that I think are not great in grief because they're so inaccurate, you know, secondary loss or vicarious loss, or, you know, in reality, you're just always scrambling to kind of put yourself back together in a way that makes sense to you. And it's really hard work. You kind of have to grow it. You have to grow. I mean, I think about this a lot because I have three kids. You know, I wasn't a mother until I was a mother. It didn't matter that I had seen my sister go through it or my best friend go through it. like my children grew that piece of me for me. And I grew it alongside the need of, you know, being a mom. I needed to be a mom and grow into being a mom all at the same time. And I think of grief as being identical to that, which is that you need to have grown the capacity to grieve at the exact same time that you use that capacity to grieve. And it's excruciating. And the way that I grieved for my dad didn't work, you know, and the way that I've taught other clients to grieve didn't work. I had to grow.
How did you grieve for your father that didn't work? What
was you know, that? Talk therapy did not work for me. And so that was really what happened with the writing, and it was such a blissful, extraordinary gift to find, because I wrote some when I was younger, but I've never taken writing seriously. But you know, when I talk to someone and they reflect me back to me, I come to understand myself better. And what was happening in grief therapy was my therapist, who I've known a long time, was reflecting back to me that I did not understand myself, that I did not make sense to myself. And so the writing, which was this creative process, and probably honestly from a different, you know, part of my brain, the writing became a way, the way I describe it is like picking up a stone and just turning it over and over until you have memorized it, so that you feel confident that you could put it in a pile and find it again. Mm. It was such a relief to let the things, you know, I had PTSD, which is that circling of images and thoughts kind of relentlessly. And I had good treatment like EMDR and IFS therapy. But in order to really let the stories go, I had to feel like I had honored them by fully understanding them. And so I have written like the event of learning of my mother's death probably 70 times. And so I feel really confident that I don't have to think about it all the time, because I have it in 70 different places. It's secure.
Hi everyone, excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast.
Important what you're saying here, Megan. It's to accept the reality of the loss. We need to relive it over and over and over again. And it's like, you know, when we first experience a traumatic loss or even unexpected loss, every cell of our body, like there is no part of our being that is not affected by this loss. And it's almost like we write about it once, you know, it sinks in this much. We write about it again, it sinks in this much. But we have to either, you know, for you, it was writing. For some people, it is the telling and the retelling. Totally. For others, it's the sweating, the running and the sweating. Absolutely. But we need to find whatever way supports us to process our grief. That's until our body knows this is true, they are gone, and they're not coming back.
Right. It's updating the software so that it you know, gets the full update. And as a trauma therapist, what I know to look for, and I was lucky to have this as a background, but I also think, you know, I think it says something about how poorly we do grief, that even with, you know, 20 years of experience and education, I still had to scramble a little bit to get the right kinds of treatments. But as a trauma therapist, what we're afraid of is that the telling and the retelling re-traumatizes, that our bodies have this natural way of progressing through grief. And, you know, I hate the phrase getting stuck. I hate the concept, as any grief therapist does, and I think any griever does, because it all minimizes the actual seismic shift of what profound grief really is, which is just a game changer forever. You know, I go back to the parenting analogy. Like, I'm never not going to be a parent. No one's ever saying to me, are you back to yourself? Like, I have kids now. I will never not have kids. I have, you know, I have lost my mom. I will never not have lost her. So in trauma, what can happen is you're running and you're sweating and you're dissociating and you're not in your feelings, but you're not actually progressing through. And so that's the, you know, for talk therapy for me, I wasn't progressing through the way that I normally would. It was not providing me a sense of relief. I did not know myself better. The, again, there are some phrases you and I know, like making meaning of something, which I really think is just a way of saying to someone, you have integrated the information. I often use with clients the idea of fresh grief, you know, that grief is, you are in it right now, and that you can have fresh grief 12 years from now. You know, there are a lot of people who, in their experience of loss in the moment, part of what they know is going to happen is their dad is also not going to be there when they're walking down the aisle, and he's not going to meet his grandchildren. And you know what? Those things do produce new and different grief. It is a new kind of loss that your dad is not here 12 years from now. So that element is one piece, which I think has its own host of stuff, and a lot of body regulation is needed there. That's when people are really not sleeping and they can't eat, and their somatic, you know, response to the is the way I describe it is my body just felt like it was ringing like a Tibetan singing bowl, like just never stopping.
And it is, isn't it? It's like that's the nervous system is just shook.
It is. Yeah. And again, like you and I have said this, the number of people that don't understand that disturbed sleep, like we have some stats on this, like people report disturbed sleep for years.
Yeah.
And that stinks, but it's not abnormal. And it's really important to let someone know that they're not grieving badly or poorly or ineffectually just because they're still waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, which by the way, is when everyone wakes up. Yeah. And then there's this other phrase, which I think is like that part that isn't quite fresh, but it's more, you know, you still have to kind of remind your mind and your system and your body that they're not here. So you'll be thinking about Thanksgiving and then suddenly have to say, oh my gosh, it won't be at my mom's house. She's not here. And it, you know, it can have that resurgence, but you're like integrating it, you know? And then there's that phase that we get into, which is a true phrase. We can still have fresh grief there, but we kind of acclimated. I don't need to be reminded that I don't do Christmas.
Yeah, and it's not so scary. I think people are less scared of their grief. I'm thinking of you there in the UK with your family and them not getting it and you having this very lonely internal experience. And I think what we also need to realize is depending on our childhood and our attachment styles, that can be horrific for some people. So you had the wherewithal to go, okay, this is really lonely. Nobody's talking about my mom's death. I'm going to take to writing. I'm going to find this way to process it. Somebody else with a poor attachment style might choose to roar and yell at all those family members and end up having a huge family rift. So it's really important, you know, the ripple effects of grief for somebody who maybe doesn't have the wherewithal to, you know how to channel it or how to hold it themselves or support and resource themselves can be really huge. There can be a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Fallout.
Yes, that's right.
A lot of really negative fallout from a grieving person who doesn't have access to psychoeducation.
That's right.
And I think, you know, psychoeducation more than any other form of counseling or therapy is absolutely vital when we're working with grief. People need to understand that what they're going through is normal, and here's why, and here's what's happening, because that can provide such relief.
Yeah, you know, I think about this a lot. Well, so let me say one thing, which is I don't think I was thinking I'm doing something very healthy for myself by sitting down and reading. I think it was my desperate attempt that was probably more informed subconsciously by all the other work, you know, therapy work that I've done, so that I didn't decide to go out drinking or go rage to my poor in-laws downstairs. But I do think, you know, the notion that we don't have any core education on grief is insane. I don't know if this happens in Ireland, but my daughter is, turning 13 tomorrow. When she was 11, she had 2 weeks of classes on puberty. So it was, this is what's going to happen to your body. This is what's going to happen to the boy's body. You know, these are, it covered gender and it covered sexuality and it covered sex. I mean, these are hot topics. And my daughter was mortified. I mean, it was probably developmentally, because she's young, a lot for her to take in. And she, every day she would come home and say, please, please, please write me a note. I don't want to do this. And every day I would say to her, honey, nobody wants to do it, but it's where we're all headed and you need the information. We don't have anything. And you know, in reality, profound loss and grief is, it's a developmental stage of life. You just don't know when you're going to go through it. You know, there are some people that go through it at age 5 and there are some people who go through it at age 55. But it is stunning to me that we say to everybody, like, just take that into your therapy hour and you can go reinvent the wheel. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. I mean, you know, because you do this hour after hour after hour. And I know because everyone who comes in says to me, I can't believe I feel this way. And I want to pull 100 people in off the street and say, did you feel this way when you went? Can you just tell them that you also felt this way?
Yeah.
And there are some books, you know, I may have mentioned this to you. So I couldn't read when my dad died and I couldn't stop reading when my mom died. So I read 112 books on grief and loss. My poor husband, every time mail, he'd be like, so is this going to be one of those uplifting books you've ordered? Because I really wanted to know what was already out there before I made any attempts to sort of extrapolate and cull down what I think good grief education is. But I have written a curriculum that I would give away to any university that wants it, which has two pieces to it. One is, this is what's normal in grief. And that spectrum is as wide as sexuality. You know, one of the things that's been really stunning in this country to me is that we have, in a very short span of time, asked our entire population, some begrudgingly, but we've asked it of them, to understand that gender and sexuality come across a spectrum. And I'm amazed at how gracefully people have taken that in, right? I mean, all of a sudden there are pronouns underneath, you know, everybody's names in this country. Now, we need more and we will always need more. But that is done with the belief that we need to make room so that there is not additional trauma to the folks who live in a non-binary world, because their suicidality rate is absurd. So, you know, obviously there's a population that's going to resist that because they don't believe in it and all of that. But for the most part, you know, the good citizens, we just don't want to cause harm. So I know, because I've watched that happen in my lifetime, that we have the capacity to take in information from experts and follow that. So, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that's on my, that I put up on my blog and my Instagram pretty regularly are these, just, they're just little panels that say, if you don't, if it feels awkward and you don't know what to do, just ask the one of these questions. And the questions are you eating? Are you sleeping? Is there a time of day that's really hard? Is there someone who's been helpful? Is there someone who hasn't been helpful? Do you have a, you know, a spiritual base that helps you at all? Just, and then don't say anything. Just let them talk. Because if someone wants to talk, that is a verbal indication that you're sliding over to let them sit down next to you. And if they don't want to talk, they don't have to sit down. But the saying of any of the things, you know, at least they're with Jesus, or, you know, they don't have to suffer anymore, or thank God you went to Egypt together last year. Mm-hmm. Those are minefields. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone, the same way I had a really rich conversation with an elderly gentleman who did not want to harm his now grandson, whom he had previously known as a granddaughter. And I said, our goal here is not to make the world perfect for your grandchild. It's so that you can put your head on your pillow at night and feel good about yourself when you go to sleep. And I honestly don't understand how some people put their head on their pillow at night and feel good about how they go to sleep in terms of how they approach grievers. They are doing damage, and it wouldn't be difficult to offer them a plate to choose from of things that would make it gentler, more simpler, and clearer. The message being, I'm sorry you are in this place. There's really nothing I can do to help except tell you that I care that you're there. It just, I don't think it's that hard. I think we haven't made it a priority.
I think anybody who's experienced a difficult time is able to be that person. And it doesn't mean that they have gone through the death of someone they love, but maybe they've gone through a divorce or a breakup, or they've had a serious illness or experienced extreme loneliness. But it's like back to that existential loneliness. Once we've experienced that in our lives in some shape or form, we recognize it in other people. But I think most of us are too scared, you know, to slide into that place because it's painful, right? And I think that's what's happening. I think collectively, we've got the blinkers on and we've got our hands, fingers in our ears going, no, 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 no. And especially like, you know, in recent years with the whole positivity movement and positive psychology and let's be happy. And, you know, like, honestly, when someone says love and light to me, I want to fucking slap them across the face. It's like, get off your cloud and put down your halo. And can we please be real? And, you know, I'm someone who, like, I get really anxious around love and light. I need to see your shadow. I need to see your pain. I need to see the real you, and then I can settle. Quite the opposite of what we see. But I think it's not, I think that's it. I think people are just scared. And, you know, even last night I had this really precious little moment with my kids where my 10-year-old had gone to bed, and I knew that wasn't a good sign, going to bed without being asked to. And I went in and got under the covers with him and just put my arms around him, and he started sobbing and sobbing, and, you know, very out of character, and there was something going on. And I just lay there and I said, I'm sorry you're feeling so bad, and, you know, this sounds really painful. And the more I just met him where he was, the more he sobbed. And then his 13-year-old brother came in and he's like, oh, what's going on? And I said, come in. I asked my kid who was crying, can he come in? And he came, the other guy came in. And I said, let's make a love sandwich, you know. So I was one side, 13-year-old was the other side, and we were all squished in this single bed with this little 10-year-old sobbing. And my 13-year-old immediately started trying to make it better, fix it, you know, give him suggestions. Remember this, I think. And I said, no, no, no. You know, the best thing we can do right now is just be here with him while he lets all these tears out, because then they're out, they're not in, and that feels so much better. But it took me a few kind of shutting up, 13-year-old, like, no, just gentle hand on his shoulder, because he kept trying to fix it, you know? Yeah. And eventually he settled with his brother's grief, and the three of us just lay there for quite a while. And that was it. That was that gorgeous moment. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that my 13-year-old was doing what everybody tries to do because he was uncomfortable with it. And I think Absolutely. Those of us who can really sit with it, it's because we've sat with our own grief. It doesn't scare us. We know it.
Absolutely. That sounds like such a beautiful mom moment that you'll always remember. And I do think, you know, I've been very open with, you know, I have no shame and no energy about the fact that I went to treatment, inpatient treatment for PTSD. I was open with my clients about that. I was open with my kids about it. I had a mom call me in the neighborhood and was like, what are we telling the children about where you're going to be? And I was like, you can tell them I'm going to be at trauma camp. Like, I'm not. And partly that's my commitment to modeling that this is just normal, that we, you know.
Let's rewind.
Oh, sure.
right at the very beginning, you said your father had been ill for a while, he died, you kind of half coped with it, the talk therapy didn't work, but then your mother died very quick. I mean, there was 2 years between their deaths. Your dad died in 2017. Your mother died, as you said, when you were on holidays with her just last year, or 2019. Yeah. And you said that that was completely different.
Completely different.
I want to come to the trauma camp and find out about that. We don't have them in Ireland at all.
Oh, okay.
But I really want to talk to you about somatic experiencing and sensory motor psychotherapy and all these body-based approaches to handling trauma. But before that, if you wouldn't mind, because a lot of people, you know, maybe not, maybe I'm diminishing people's understanding, but understand trauma as something like a car accident or a sexual assault or these big things. And trauma can actually, you know, be very present and very everyday things that a lot of us experience, but we just don't think it's trauma. Just take us back and explain what your experience was and why it was trauma and why it invoked PTSD for you as well.
Maybe. Sure. So, you know, there are a million different definitions of trauma. So the one that I like, that I think encompasses everything, you know, you're right, there's trauma as a car accident, which I think the field previously, and it's changing now, would call that a big T trauma, just a single event. And you and I could be in the same car accident, and you would never get back in a car and I would walk out and have no problem. So you were traumatized, I wasn't. And then they used to call it little T. We're trying to move away from this because it makes one sound more important or bigger than the other. But what they mean in distinguishing it is one is more like developmental trauma. So there's developmental trauma, which is probably closer towards some of the stuff that we do in attachment, which is attachment therapy and attachment models, which is more that there were needs that you specifically needed to have met that weren't over time, and you created meaning from it. So that's the key in trauma, is that whatever it was that happened, whether it was in your childhood over time or a single event, that your system created meaning from it, that it is a permanent piece of data that you then use to create how you go out into the world from here.
And just to say as well that pervasive childhood trauma where needs aren't met over and over and over again can produce an adult as if they've been in three car crashes.
Absolutely.
You know, it is as damaging and undermining as the big T, if you like.
In the trauma world, I think what we would tell you is developmental trauma informs every event afterwards, and that, you know, the sort of the wiring of the system. So for example, if you were someone who physically craved hugs and neither of your parents were huggers, they didn't beat you, they didn't shame you, but they just were not physically affectionate, that need going unmet for a sustained amount of time will likely mean that you tried to meet that need somehow. And without the support of a good functioning way to meet your need for physical touch or education with your parents so that they can stretch their own, you'll come up with a childlike way, which might be you got in fights. So trauma, again, is that thing that, you know, it informs how we move forward. If our needs aren't met, the trauma can be really dysfunctional. So there are people who have worked through developmental trauma in super healthy ways and would tell you that now the fact that their parents, didn't talk to them about sexuality, it no longer holds the same weight because they were able to go back and sort of reprocess their needs as an adult. And in the IFS world, which is one that I'm trained in, really what that means is you show up for your child as the adult that you are now. You know, you
and
kind
just
of
go to say to listeners, IFS that Megan's referring to is internal family systems. Is that the work of Richard Schwartz?
It is. Schwartz? Yep. Yeah. It is. And in a broad brushstroke, essentially what that means is we have lots of different needs that are running around inside our systems, and that it's really our responsibilities as adults to make sure that those needs get met. So
thank you for that overview. So back to your personal experience.
My attachment with my dad was a relatively distant guy. And what I would say is as I grew, probably even in young adolescence and adolescence, my actual just sort of need for him concretely, like to give me money and to drive me places, diminished. And my emotional need for him also diminished. He and I had very separate views on things. I was very aware when he was dying that I wanted to participate in him dying, that I really wanted to keep him company. And we had, over the course of that year, the easiest year of our relationship ever, because my expectations were really, really low. I just wanted him to feel loved. I just wanted him to know that he was important. And we had beautiful conversations. I helped him plan I think probably I was the only person he was talking to directly about his understanding of dying. And so, you know, I still have all his personal contacts in my phone because I called everyone that he wanted personally called after he died. I mean, his death was hard, but it was not traumatic. I understood what was happening. It didn't shock me. When my mom died, although when I look back at it now, there may have been a subconscious understanding that she was not well. It was a short illness. It was, you know, a couple weeks long. And so there may have been some, but it was not conscious. I fully expected her to get better. And, you know, what happens in trauma from a very basic standpoint is there is like a terror and a startle response from the back of your brain. So at the very base of your brain, where your amygdala sits, is the fight, flight, you know, flee, feign death response. And that was the response that got, you know, activated to an 11 when I discovered that she died. So, and people report on this, they get information and they have really odd thinking. And some of that thinking makes them feel very ashamed. You know, they discovered that their father died, had a stroke and died. And their first thought was, oh my gosh, who's going to drive me to the airport? And what we know about that from a neurobiological standpoint is your critical thinking comes from this part of your brain at the front, at your forehead, and your amygdala is at the back of your neck. And what the amygdala does is it enlarges and it literally chokes off the oxygen, the neural pathways to the front of the brain. So your thinking is really muddled for a really long time. So when people are like, why can't I think straight? Why can't I remember? You know, sequence of events, it's literally because your brain has swollen in odd ways from the concrete startled response. So I had...
Yes, you were able to read after your mom died, which really surprises me because, you know, in part of the fight, flight or freeze, I think the blood drains from the prefrontal cortex also to go into the muscles to get ready to run or fight. And that's why, you know, our problem solving, our ability to read, retain, memorize, that all goes to pot.
Exactly. I didn't read probably for 2.5 months. With my dad, it was like a year. It was a year. And I couldn't read anything longer than a magazine article. And then just one day I picked up a Sarah Winman book and suddenly I could read again.
Yeah. Specific in your reading material as well, which probably made a difference. You weren't reading novels.
That's exactly. And with my mom, again, I think what was happening, because I was still in those early days really looking to do talk therapy. I hadn't quite. So before I found the writing, which became so cathartic and helped me do the journeying and the processing through, I was more sort of, I always think of like Pooh and Piglet walking around the tree in Winnie the Pooh. You know, they keep seeing their own footprints and then they get scared that those footprints are a monster behind them. I had a bit of that phase. And in that phase, I was just devouring every expert's everything about grief. There's this beautiful C.S. Lewis quote, which is that we read to feel understood. And I was reading to find myself in the texts.
Yeah.
So it was very panicked. I mean, I was staying up all late at night and I didn't find myself in those texts. I found some little pieces of relief, but more I found myself on grief and loss boards with other people telling their more visceral stories.
Sorry, Megan, just to butt in there, but I think a lot of people who write books on grief, it's in hindsight. It's when they're already making meaning and, you know, they've kind of wrapped it up nicely, perhaps. Whereas when you're in that fresh grief or that chronic grief at the beginning, it's just, it's like there's something crawling inside you and you're trying to find anyone else to resonate with. So you know you're not going crazy.
The Year of Magical Thinking, which is it Joan Didion? Joan Didion. That book is written from fresh grief and it's almost hard to, take in because it's so triggering for a lot of people, but it's just the truest of grief. And, you know, that book, if other folks have read it, is really about an enmeshed partnership and a partnership where she really just cannot live without her partner. And in fact, she went on to get married shortly thereafter. Because so much of her identity, I think, is probably connected to another person. With my mom, there's the whole series of events that happen after a funeral. And so many, I'm not even the thousandth person to talk about this. You get connected to those things that need to be done. And it's almost like a relief. You know, what happened just after she died is that I raced to get to her body. Well, let me say this. Part of the trauma of my mom's death is that I knew she died before I was told. So I was in a car with my kids picking up a cousin about an hour and a half from my mom's house. And I had the sensation in my stomach of water breaking, like a pregnancy.
Wow.
And I looked, all of my three children were up getting their cousin from the house. And I looked down fully expecting to see like wet everywhere. And then I had a thought that was as clear as anything, which is she's dead. So my husband was back at the house because he was working where my mom was an hour and a half away, 17 minutes away. And I called him and said, have you seen my mom? And she's a very early riser like me. And he said, no, it's funny, I haven't seen her. And I was like, she's dead. You have to go into her room. And she was dead.
Wow.
So part of that, that is the most profound time in my life that has happened, but I have had physical knowings inside my body about things that I couldn't possibly intellectually know before. But that was a very difficult thing to recover from, was sort of the knowing inside my body. I would have rather disassociated from that. But the trauma of having a physical system that takes in information in a way that you can't necessarily know what the meaning of it is in the moment is really something that we all, you know, we're all scanning and taking in information. And so we know things that we don't intellectually know, all of us. My skill at reading it or feeling it or the degree to which I experience it might not be totally typical, but I don't think it's totally off the charts either. So I had that experience and then we had a funeral for my mom and all the processes of that, including, you know, the same thing that I had done at my father's request, which was call everyone. You know, I was in a parking lot with my car, my minivan idling when my husband called me back. He told me I needed to pull over. So it took me, I don't know, 6 miles before I could find somewhere safe to pull over. And then he told me that she had died. And I urgently felt the need to tell all five of my siblings. So I stood in this crappy, broken down parking lot for like an off-brand Dairy Queen and called my five siblings to tell them our mother had died. And I was very much like, I'm a trauma therapist. They're going to remember this for the rest of their lives. I have to do this well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do it well, but I put a lot of pressure on myself. When we got to the end of her funeral.
What was not doing it well like, Megan?
Well, you know, I have some real regret because about a year after she died, I woke up in the middle of the night and was like, I have every one of my siblings' partners' phone numbers. I could have so easily given them the gift of hearing from someone that they loved in a much more supported state than what they got. And I have some real grief that I couldn't have done that for them, that we were all sort of vicariously traumatized by the same shocking event. None of them feel that way. What happened immediately, like right in the parking lot, and what I said to all of them was, it's my fault she died. That it is my fault, because I knew she was sick and I had taken her to the doctor and we had had a fight about whether she should go back to the doctor. Intellectually, I absolutely understand that it is not my fault my mother died. But I will tell you that I still hold that belief and battle that thought most days. That it is, and from the IFS perspective, what I know that is me having difficulty navigating the helplessness that exists with loss. You know, what, when you were talking about your son and not wanting his little brother to feel bad, you know, I think even from the earliest age, we have a hard time with that helplessness, that sense of, I love you, I don't want you to feel this way. That is really like existentially French poetry kind of way, the hardest space to be in. And so I know that my own thought is, it must be your fault, Megan, you could have done something. And that part comes in to beat me up rather than leave me alone with that helpless, truly profoundly grief-laden place, which is, I have to live without her.
And I think it's our need, Megan, for meaning. I would support Absolutely. Women after their babies have died. And rather than sit with, we don't know why, it was a random roll of a dice, some babies die, most don't, it's easier for them to go, it was my fault. Because I didn't go to the hospital sooner, because I had a bath, or because I went for that long walk. We so desperately need a reason rather than that big unknown, that we'd rather beat ourselves up sometimes than sit with the what if of it all.
Because the haphazard, you know, again, like if you go into the organization around religion, part of the beauty of what religion offers you is some kind of organizational structure. Whether it's, I don't know if you know Kate Bowler, who wrote a beautiful book about getting cancer as a young woman, but she is the foremost studier of the prosperity Bible, which is this whole belief that some Christians in this country have, which is like, if you do good things, God will give you good things. You know, at the root of her experience, she was studying about that concept, and she randomly, with a brand new baby, got, you know, was diagnosed with stage four cancer. And I think most of us know that, like, we don't get what we deserve. We don't control, you know, we know that that's not the truth. Yeah. So there is
manifest cancer. 1-year-old kids don't manifest cancer, you know? This is white privilege speaking. When you've got all these fabulous things that you tell yourself you've manifested, it's maybe it's something to do with the color of your skin and your economic background.
There's a beautiful, like, just brutal interview with the actor Stephen Fry from Monty Python about the concept of God. And he says, you know, with lots of expletives, why in the world would I want to believe that there was a God who was willing to let children get leukemia? Why is that a good thing? So there's, I think, I mean, even with young children, you know, we want to tell them something that's going to be soothing. And I am very careful with my kids to not, you know, to say, this is the way that I feel. I don't have any answers. I don't know either. This is normal, to model that, because in my family, we had an experience of losing a beloved teenager in our town when we were young. And again, I think it was the, you know, early 80s. There was a different ethos then, a different understanding. It was like, don't talk to kids about these terrible things. And the problem is, when you don't talk to kids about things, about feelings, they still have the feelings and they don't have any way to support it. And when you don't support children in feelings, how they feel becomes who they are.
Yeah. It's so, like, they have this bottom up experience with no meaning making for it. And it's scary. And they'll fill in the meaning if it's not offered to them as well.
Right. And so that sort of loops back to my own trauma, which was, you know, I couldn't make any meaning of my mother's death. She was very religious. Her religious community had a lot of, she knew this was happening. This was, and I just knew that wasn't true. I mean, I was with her, like, she wouldn't have left her coffee cup in the sink if she thought she was laying down to die. She, you know, so I was, there was a, like, a division of a certain people who were able to find immediate comfort in the way that she died, which in fact was really beautiful. I mean, it's the most beautiful way someone could die, which was, she had just seen every one of her children, two of whom were in Seattle, her brother who was in Seattle, and we live in New England. So that was, you know, not, that was a once a year kind of event. She had just gone to see a Monsignor who she was very dear friends with and got a blessing because she hadn't felt well. We had fought about that because I had told her I didn't want her driving. And she died with her rosary in her hands, in her sleep, in her favorite pajamas in her home, and was discovered by her son-in-law, who she probably would have picked. He's probably who she would have picked. So there's this juxtaposition of the most beautiful death in the world that also traumatized me beyond, you know, recognition of myself. So the trauma, as you asked about it, for me was that I know myself to be, in my body and as a person, happy all the time. I have bad things that happen, but they happen to me and I stay contained. I know who I am. I understand myself. I could not understand myself without her as the tether. She felt like a stake in the ground that I was rooted to. And some of that honestly is religion, because she was so faithful and she had an organizing structure that when I felt out of control, I would call her and say, can you call up your little old ladies and pray about this, even though I don't really believe in that? And so it was that way of, like, she would provide me a safe way of love and care that without her, I felt very just unlike myself. Unlike myself in my own body, unlike myself in the world. And I had looping in my mind. By the time I got down, so we had her funeral, I left her home, I came back to my house in Washington, D.C., my kids went back to school. So it was all about a month and a half, and I knew what was happening. I would get my kids out to school, and I would go and sit on my porch and just kind of rewatch the tape in my mind of, and I had these little strategies, like, okay, I'll only let myself think about it until we get to the parking lot, or I'll only let myself think about it until I get to her body and pray the rosary, or I'll only, it never ever was, I'm not gonna think about it, because I didn't have any control over the loop and the tape. And then I started to do some things to try to manage it. You know, I'd sleep in the daytime because it was worse in the daytime, and I'd be up at night. And then I had a somatic response, which is what my body does, which was I threw my back out so badly that I couldn't get off the floor to even use the bathroom. And then I called a friend and said, I can't even function anymore. And I feel really lucky and unbelievably grateful that I knew who to call, that I could hand, you know, my healthcare over to her. And she literally said, watch this movie on Netflix, I'll call you in 2 hours. Wow. And she called me in 2 hours with a plane, yeah, plan, you know, a treatment plan, a place to go. And I did, I went to an unbelievable program in Tennessee here that is, you know, it's not for addiction, because that's not the, that wasn't the problem that I had. But there are many addicts there, because addiction is, you know, a tool that we use to manage trauma. But it's a trauma facility, a facility for people who are having a stuck space, not in grief, but a stuck space in the experience of the trauma that needs to get resolved. And there were, you know, a million modalities, but the modalities in trauma really have to be, you use the phrase, they really have to be bottom up. Because we don't have an intellectual understanding of why, you know, we can't sleep or why our mind is looping on a tape. I mean, we have some intellectual understanding, but actually the intellectual, me knowing why that happens didn't stop it from happening. I need to stop it from happening. And so one beautiful example in the IFS world, so the parts world, I did a session with a therapist. And IFS involves EMDR, which is the eye movement and desensitization and reprocessing, involves moving with stimulation, tapping or your eyes, some of your memories across your brain, the stimulation of that. IFS brings in, you know, a partnership between you as a little kid, your emotional states, which are young, and your adult resources. So I did this beautiful session with this therapist. I mean, this really only took like a couple of hours where she asked me, in the moment that you're receiving the news that your mom died, you're an hour and 17 minutes away, you have four children in the car who you don't want to convey this news to, what do you need? And it was just clear as a bell. I wanted my older brother and his wife, who I'm close to pull up and help me. And so we did that as an imaginary process. And even though that didn't happen, it sort of feels like that's what happened. So even though that wasn't what happened in the experience of being in the therapy, that really, really, really wildly vulnerable part that doesn't, I mean, I had a moment in that parking lot where I was like, okay, I have to take care of the kids in that car. And in trauma treatment, sort of what they said was, I left myself in the parking lot and I took care of the kids instead.
Yeah.
And so trauma treatment for me, which was really, at first, the concept of it was excruciating. The experience of it was really healing, was to actually not talk to my kids a lot while I was there, to trust that they were covered by my husband and the people that were here. Other people were Zooming with their kids, and my treatment was not to do that, not to see them physically, to, you know, it was only 3 weeks long. They could handle it, and they did.
But to show up for yourself, find that part of you that could show up for that frozen, abandoned self in the parking lot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is a really good example of, you know, trauma around death. And I've said this before in the podcast, there can be a traumatic death, but it doesn't mean that everyone will be traumatized. And there can be a very peaceful death, as your mom had, and yet there was a trauma response.
That's exactly right. And I was the only one in my family that was so deeply traumatized, even though we all experienced, you know, such a sudden death. And I am not the person who was the most emotionally close to my mom.
Yeah.
In Megan, fact, I would argue it was closer to both of my sisters. Sorry.
I'm curious about, you know, your analogy of the car crash earlier and how there can be a car crash and two people are in it. One gets out, brushes off and goes for lunch. The other one comes out and is traumatized for months, years, forever. What do you think is what predisposes somebody to trauma? What do you think, well, I suppose generally, but also you know, what is it about ourselves or our
system? I'm fascinated by this, and I've done a lot of study in this, and I there is a lot in the movement of ACEs here, the adverse childhood experiences, which, you know, I don't know how that's going to shake out in terms of whether or not it informs that, you know, we can really predict, but I like how it's being used, which is essentially, we're asking a series of questions of, did you have any of these experiences as a child? And then saying these people might be at more risk of being, you know, and of needing more support so that they don't process their experiences through alcoholism or unemployment or so we're doing that here in this country. I think everybody's doing it, but so I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if we're predisposed because of our, you know, our experiences in our lives that adults don't provide enough support or we're not safe enough. What I can tell you from my own experience is that I do think that bears out to be true in my office as a clinician, that I do think that people who are really significantly impacted, kind of like cut down at the knees by events in their adult life, I almost always find unprocessed events from their childhood that are connected. And it's fascinating because often people will start to think about things in their childhood and not understand, why am I thinking about this terrible thing that happened to my sister when I was 10, now that my partner has cancer? And, you know, again, we know a lot about how the brain clusters information. And so, you know, it clusters information based on your emotional experiences. So if you were afraid then and you're afraid now, they're going to be sitting next to each other and they may rattle each other. That's exciting for treatment because you can work on any one of those things and sort of help soothe the system. I did have, you know, when I was in third grade, from second grade going into third grade. So I was turning eight, turning nine. There was this death, a drowning in the small town that I grew up in. And my brother discovered the body. It was friends of the family. My mom was involved. My mom had terrible PTSD, which I didn't know, but could feel the energy of as a child. So our family went from feeling very normal and stable to feeling very unsafe. And I didn't have any of the language to understand that. It's interesting that when I was cleaning out my mom's house, I found my report cards. And that year, the teachers are saying things like, Megan's talking back, she's acting out. So all that stuff that we know, which is like kids will make it known how they're doing, I was doing. But I think mostly I was a compliant child. So people probably scolded me for my behavior and I took it even more inward.
This is reminding me of the work of Tashel Bordera, Suffocated Grief.
Yeah.
And she's identified how a lot of children, particularly Black children in the States, not only is their grief not supported, but they're actually pushed down because of it, because they're expressing their grief through their behavior, you know, because you know, like you talked about the transgender population earlier and how there's disproportionately high rates of suicide or suicidal ideation. The same is true in the Black population. And so there's more people dying, there's more murders, there's more suicides, and therefore the fallout is greater. But a lot of kids are being suffocated in their grief because they're acting out in exactly the way you describe as well.
Yeah. And so what that makes me think of, you had said earlier that, you know, people who are able to have the conversations about grief are people who have gone through traumatic events. And I think there's an argument to say that actually there's probably a percentage of people who, you know, it's like all of a sudden you learn Portuguese and there are these other native Portuguese speakers and we're just so grateful to find each other as expats in this world. But I would argue that there's probably an even larger percentage of people who went through trauma unsupported that don't want to hear anything, that are the greatest perpetrators of silencing around this. Because if you start talking about it, it's going to rattle their cage and they can't have that happen. And so their unprocessed grief and trauma actually, it's almost like they sneeze it on their hands and then they wipe it on you and you're even, you know, it's worse for you. Yeah. So, you know, part of what I know, I had done a lot of work over this loss from childhood. And I want to be clear, you know, that family is still a big part of my life. They're really important to me and my family, but I didn't lose that teenager as a child. I mean, he was my sailing instructor. I loved him as part of a collective. What I lost was a sense of safety in the world.
Yeah.
And no capacity to talk about what it is. And so, you know, I was like this surly little kid when people were talking about this book that we were reading in school and they were saying, you know, oh, the dog died. I'm like, dog died? The kids die. You don't even know. Parents don't keep anyone safe. But really that was now my experience at 9 years old, which is not developmentally appropriate. Like your mind begins in a natural course, your mind will come to the concept of like, oh my God, people die, but it's not at nine. And, you know, Erikson and Piaget, like they helped us sort of scope out when the brain is able to deal with those concepts, but it's not nine. So what I learned from that process, because I didn't have models to talk about it, was I was the pathological one. Everyone else seemed fine. And so I was the problem. And we're just going to keep that tighter and quieter and tighter and quieter. And I think I tend to that, even though I know it's wrong, even though I know it makes me sick, in most events, when most events happen and I have a really strong amount of feeling, I isolate and go inward. And it was interesting because even though I've done addiction work for a long time, when I went to this trauma facility in Tennessee, which is called Milestones at Onsite, it's a beautiful program. When I went there, they were the first ones to that I had ever seen describe isolating as an addiction, meaning a tool that you use to disassociate from feeling. And that blew my mind. I mean, I've been a clinician a long time and I was like, oh my God, that's what I, and so that was part of sort of the intellectual getting curious about what does that do for me? And what it does for me is it brings me back into the re-traumatized state of an under-supported child. And I sit there with that, I am the problem and there's no way to get help. And so what I've learned to do is go outward, you know, even if I just text somebody and say, I'm having a really hard time, that is more, even if they don't respond, going outward and letting people know that I'm having a hard time is a trauma interrupter. That is an immediate, different course of action that makes me feel different in my body because now I'm connected to somebody else.
Absolutely. And it's, we've such a tendency to isolate in grief. That's what I'll often say to people is, could you just commit to connecting in some shape or form with somebody today, anybody, you know, even if you're not talking about your grief, that you'll just see someone or make contact. I think physical touch as well, you know, for our nervous system, just that physical touch, just someone, you know, we have this beautiful expression to sit with. And to sit with, you know, sometimes I, in my room here, my therapy room, I have a sofa because I want to sit with people at times, not always. Sometimes I will say, can I come and sit beside you? And even if it's just my forearm touching their forearm as they weep and cry, you know, or as they talk, just some sort of physical connection can be incredibly soothing for the body. It's something that we really underestimate. And I think it's somewhere, I don't know what it's like in the States, but undergraduate school here, you know, when we're learning therapy, how to be therapists, there's a big thing that says touch is a no-no. And sometimes I have a supervisor, Dr. Susan Delaney, I remember her saying the unethical nature of touch. And she says that in grief, it's almost unethical not to touch. You know, obviously conscious, thought out, appropriate touch. But I remember being with a therapist once and realizing I'm just spieling out the same old shit again and again and again. I'm going nowhere. And I looked at her one day and I said, would you just sit on the floor? And can I just sit on the floor too? And can we just sit there back to back? And we did that for a few sessions without even talking. And I could say they were the best therapy sessions I ever had. Just feeling her spine against my spine. And you know, she was a little bit older, so she wasn't that comfortable physically in that position, although she was 300% willing to do it. But the result is that years later now, sometimes when I need to resource myself, I imagine her hand on my back.
That's beautiful.
And it's like, I just can feel the love and the support and the congruence and her presence, just her hand on my back. And I think as any therapist listening, just think about touch, the healing balm of touch.
I think what you're saying is so important. And the somatic training that I've done, you know, they have studies that will regulate, you know, watch heartbeats regulate through touch, you know. So we know from holding babies that when they're agitated and crying and you press them against your chest, if you press them against your skin even, they regulate, just, you know, they calm down and they soothe. And so we have a lot of information that says exactly what you're saying, which is there's humanity in touch. I think when we're training young therapists, there's a fear, you know, one of the things, if we had a client of mine in the room right now and you said, what is Megan's favorite phrase? It would be that I don't love fear-based decisions, because there is no, you're jacked up when you're in your fear space and you are defended. And so I think when we're training little therapists who are just coming out here, we are trying to give them rules rather than grow their intuition. And what we need for young therapists, and I supervise some, as I say, I'm not trying to turn you into me and tell you what I know. I want to make you feel as safe as possible in the room. So for some people, touch is never going to work because they're not safe with touch. Touch isn't safe for them. But the notion that we shouldn't be touching therapists, you know, we shouldn't be touching clients, is kind of random. And it's based on the fear that a client is going to say that something bad happened, which, you know, that is a risk because if we're not really well attuned to our clients, we can miss. But I had this, I mentioned this to you before, you know, I took a really long time off because I had to. I had a supervision group that came to me and I said to them, I don't know what to do. I don't know when I'm ever going to be able to go back to work. And then that was in September. And they said, we want you to take off until January. And I was like, what are you talking about? That's so long. My clients, what will they do? And I mean, this is why I have peer supervision, but they were like, we will take care of this. You are no longer thinking about this. And they said it with some level of instruction, meaning like it's irresponsible if you do at this point. But I spoke to them when I came back and I said, I don't know whether to tell people where I was and what I was doing. Everyone knew my mom had died. I had shared that. And they said, take care of yourself first. What do you need? And I was like, I need to be real in the room. I need this. So even though I know when I was in social work school, the number of conversations I heard was like, do not share your personal information, do not, that I couldn't be safe in the room if people didn't understand what, that I had gone to treatment and been, it had really terrible PTSD. I needed that to be known. And so for me, that was the right decision. I'm sure there are people listening right now who are like, no way, man, that was the wrong thing that lady did. But I couldn't have done it any other way. And I think things like touch and as a modality, you know, I really hope for grievers that they work with people who are body centered, who have something other than talk therapy to offer. And that could be art. It could be writing. It could be somatic. I did these amazing breath work experiences and, you know, Reiki. There's just the way that I feel about grief work and in my, you know, personal and professional world is there is healing to be done in all kinds of ways. Yeah. We have to trust that there is healing to be had and be curious about what our system might need that we don't already know about.
And I think as well, it's you know, when we talk about young therapists, which you and I aren't.
No, we're not. We're
we need to learn those boundaries and maybe we need to work within those boundaries initially. But as we grow and develop and evolve, you know, as supporters of people who are grieving or going through trauma, we learn when we can put down the tools, put down the boundaries, because we've already internalized them very strongly. So, you know, we're safe to do it, you know, and it's not in, you know, maybe when we tell a trainee, don't touch your clients, it's we don't want them doing something inappropriate or running in to be the savior, you know. But when we're informed, when we're trauma informed and grief informed, we're coming from that place of, we have such a consciousness around it that any touch is thought out, it's informed, it's there's a reason behind it. The same with the congruence, if you saying, here's what happened to me, you know, I will, I wouldn't say often, but I do share, yeah, you know, some personal information if it's in the service of the client. Yeah. You know, I had one client who suffered from really bad anxiety. And I remember one day in a month after seeing her saying, look, when I feel really anxious, this has helped me in the moment. Of course, we've got to get to the root of the anxiety, but here's what helps me. And I'm wondering, have you ever tried that? And I could see everything change in her. I was like, you who I worship and adore have anxiety. Right. And suddenly it was like an elevation of her, you know? Which was really good for her, you know.
That kind of joining and sharing of yourself in the service of the client. I think we know that's different than telling them about a birthday party that we went to this weekend, right? Yeah. That's what we're afraid of. We're afraid we're going to bring something non-therapeutic. And I do think attunement and consent are, you know, they're models for someone else. There's a therapist, a master therapist that I worked with years ago, who, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. His name is Stan Tacton, and he runs something called Pact Therapy, which is about teaching, it's couples work, and it's about teaching people to be physically attuned. You know, when couples are arguing and it's clear they're not listening, you know, Stan's work is, why are you still talking if you know they're not listening? What are you doing? And one of the early exercises that he has couples do is give the other one the hug that you know they want. So I give my husband a short, quick hug because that's what he wants. And he gives me the long extended hug that he knows that I want. And we find sort of the middle ground. And what Stan always talks about when in training is do nothing. Just bearing witness to their story and being in the room and listening to is enough therapeutic intervention. Do nothing until you feel inspired. The moment you are curious and interested and you are inspired by intervention, that is the gift to give to them. And that is authentic. And you can bring them right into that. Hey, would you guys be willing to try this? Would it be okay if I sat closer to you? I'm just trying something out. It's very almost like improv theater. It's very in the moment and quick, but it's so well attuned. And oftentimes he videotapes all his sessions. Oftentimes you go back and you're like, I don't even know what that was. I don't know why that worked. And so when you watch Stan train, people will raise their hand and say, can you tell me more about why you did this? And he'll go, I don't fucking know why I did that. I just did it. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm a drama therapist originally. So I really get that space. There's another great expression and it says, you know, say nothing unless it's an improvement on silence.
Exactly. But I think it goes back to that thing that we're saying, which is at the core, there is such an unbelievably existential loneliness because you have lost. Your loss is all your own, just to you. That to have someone willing to sit next to you on a couch and not have to shift that or change that, but only to bear witness to it, is really holy. It is really from the core of our like energetic systems, healing and holy. And we do not teach people how to do that. And honestly, I mean, I am teaching my children. What I say is stop. You don't have to fix this. And you can't. You're not such an expert in this that you know better. Sit quietly and listen. Ask more questions about how they feel. And that, you know, that intervention is, if someone feels seen and known and heard, they don't need more than that. You are not a better expert. You don't have better ideas than what they can come up with from their own system. But they do need the pole, that piece that I lost with my mom, you know, the thing that I say all the time, which is I will miss her for the rest of my life. Is because that phrase always chokes me up, is because she was the tent pole to all of my experiences. If I was excited about something, she wanted to know about it. If I was afraid of something, she was gonna hold the fear with me. She was the external part that grounded me into the possibility that these feelings are not going to be overwhelming. They are going to be okay. People have had them before and lived. And when that no longer was there, I had to grow that part for myself. And that has taken some time. And I can't say that I feel like I'm still doing it. It may be a lifelong process for me to figure out who and how to be and live without her in the world. And I don't think that's unique to me. I think many of us have been blessed with, and by the way, I don't just mean you had the best relationship with your mom. I mean, she was an incredibly, extraordinarily unique and wonderful person that loved me uniquely in the world. But we fought a lot. We had years that were really filled with tension. She didn't approve or think everything that I did was perfect, but she was that center grounding space where I could take my own experiences and sort of examine them. There was, her phrase was, "Ooh, let me go get my tea." You know, that meant like she was going to sit and dig in and really listen. And that is super precious when you have someone who bears witness to your story with caring. It's just
a
tremendous amount to lose. It's too much to lose. It's too much. And there is no fixing it. I don't care how extraordinary your person is and how much money I could pay them or how much they could fall in love with me. They will never be able to replace my mom. That just is the truth. And I am learning that that's going to be okay. I am learning that. And I know that millions of other people have already learned that. And I do, you know, the psycho-ed piece is, I just, you know, I've said this to all the people in my writing group that I'm running right now, you know, we just need a million more voices saying, this is what grief is. This is what it feels like. It's a natural process. And we live through it. You know how many moms have lost a child and people say to them, I could never live through it. Except 98% of the population does.
Yeah. It's like an amputation. That's what it sounds like you're describing. It's like you will always miss that leg, but you will learn to live without it as well.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you don't want it back every minute of the day.
That's right.
Megan, that's lovely. When you were talking there earlier, I pulled up a quote from Parker Palmer, which, you know, you evoked in my memory as you were speaking. And the quote is, the human soul doesn't want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed, to be seen, heard, and companioned exactly as it is.
What that makes me think of, and I had a supervisor early on who said something along the lines to me of, you know, the reason that we don't want you to do anything other than sit with someone's feeling is the minute you start to try to fix it, you join with the idea that it's a problem. And our feelings are not a problem. Our feelings just are. And I say to my kids a lot, feelings are not facts. Sit with it for a minute. It may pass. But also, if it sits with you and it's a problem, then it's showing you your compass point of where you need to go. And I don't think grief is any different than that. I think grief is not a problem, but it is a compass point that we are on, and it is not clear. We don't know where we're going to end up, and we are growing into that space. And I think the idea that if people can bear witness to that with the courage that we are going to find it, the minute you start to fix, you imply that they're on, oh my God, it's like backseat driving, you know? Oh, but wait, wasn't that our exit? Yeah. Instead of, you're doing great. You're doing great. This is hard.
I think there's a skill, Megan, in navigating through all of this, you know, navigating the silences, the psychoeducation, the exploring routes, potential routes to take, back to sitting with the unknown, back to sitting with the silences. And it's somehow the balance of this where the magic happens, you know.
Yes. And the thing that I think about as a clinician, and that I really understood as someone who was traumatized, is we have to treat and help soothe the suffering, the belief that things should be other than as they are, right? That's really sort of Buddha's tenet around suffering, is that your mind believes it should not be this way. And so I use a lot in my writing the phrase, it was always going to be this way. Almost like a benediction to myself to just stay here where I am and let these feelings be as they are, and they will let me go when they're done with me. And that, you know, it's not a linear trajectory, but there is a lot of suffering that goes on in trauma and, you know, and in traumatic grief, which we really do need to bring in interventions, breath work, EMDR, you know, we need to provide relief so that people can bear with the next piece, which is the learning to live without, the learning to integrate the loss. But if we're stuck in suffering, which for me was that, you know, the PTSD of the images, if we're stuck there, we will never have that hope that things can be better. And so it's a balance between the two, because I do think bearing witness is where the healing is, but sometimes you gotta like scrape the ice off the car before you can drive it in that space. And that, yeah, it's to, you know, regulate the system, which is why as I, you know, progressed as a therapist and trained in more things, I've been so grateful for all of those approaches that are really, you know, bottom-up approaches. Like when I have a really dysregulated, agitated client, we might spend the entire time box, you know, breathing in the shape of a box while my feet are pressed on their feet. And, you know, that goes to a lot of things, but that will just be something that they have indicated to me is helping them soothe their system.
Yeah.
And if they spend every other hour out of the week in a state of high agitation and just 1 hour with me soothing their system, it's probably nowhere near enough, but it's important in the idea.
The system tastes it and gets to know it and hopefully yeah. Look for it. And I think what you're describing there is the difference between suffering and grief.
Absolutely.
And by grief in its pure form is, you know, just the weeping and the expressing of it. Like my child last night, it was just so lovely just to see it so pure coming out. But suffering is like the denial of it or the running away from it or the anxiety because we don't want to feel it. They're the bits we want to support in a more active way and then bear witness to the grief when that comes out as well.
Right. And as clinicians, we really need to believe that this is something that someone can do. You know, when I'm doing supervision of younger clinicians and they're super anxious that their client isn't going to be okay, you know, that's the piece that we need to fix, is the clinician not believing that their client is going to be okay. Because you need to be able to sit in a room with somebody and say, grief is a natural process. Nobody ever thinks they can get through it. Almost everyone does. And they're not any more human or less human or extraordinary than you are. We just, you know, you don't know how to do it yet. I will sit and be with you while that happens, because we know that isolation doubles down on it, doubles down on the sort of the fear that it isn't going to be okay. But I also think it's you know, in this country, you get an average of 2 days bereavement leave, Liz, 2 days. Can you imagine losing a child and being told and employees gather together and give you their paid leave off? I mean, that is insane to me. Again, I don't think corporations should feel good about themselves if they're giving you 2 days off. I mean, I read a document that had like, well, if it's your mother, it's this day. If it's your son, it's this day. If it's your foster child, it's like fewer hours. I mean, Yeah. It made me want to throw things.
Yeah, grief at work is something that really needs a lot of attention to it.
Yeah.
Megan, thank you so much for your time. I could literally sit here for hours talking to you.
It's
so stimulating and so interesting. But I have to meet Carrie Thompson.
Yes, 5 minutes. To do. But I'm excited about the notion of working more together. I'm so grateful for your work. I really do think everything that you put out there is rich and valuable and adds to the field rather than just, you know, like junk that gets put out there that's recycled. I'm just really, really grateful. And I'm so glad we got a chance to connect. Yeah,
thanks, Megan. And just for listeners, what Megan is referring to, I have a grief education project coming out probably in the next month or so, with lots and lots of really amazing grief and trauma-informed people who are going to be presenting on it, and it'll be available online. Very exciting. I'll do a proper introduction at some stage, but Megan is going to talk about trauma and grief, which will be an invaluable part of the project, and we'll talk about somatic experiencing, sensory motor, which is the work of Peter Levine, sensory motor psychotherapy, the work of Pat Ogden, and internal family systems, the work of Richard Swartz, and how, you know, we will touch on it in the Shapes of Grief online educational project, But as with all the speakers on the project, if you want to learn more, their details will be involved. So you'll be able to contact Megan directly for further training in that area. So Megan, thank you so much. I love talking to you today. Let's do it again, because I feel there's so much we could talk about.
Anytime. I am just absolutely delighted to be a part of your work. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Megan. Take good care.
You too, Liz. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care.
Absolutely gorgeous.